An inside view of life in China. The West's view of China is often through the lens of its economic and political importance, and polls indicate that our perceptions of this vast nation are colored by concerns about its business practices, cybersecurity, and human rights. According to a Pew survey last year, less than 40% of Americans have a favorable view of China. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll take a closer look at China and its people, at what daily life is like for the Chinese, and how much control the government still has in their lives. We talk with a panel of guests who know China well, including Rob Schmitz, the China correspondent for Marketplace, Christopher Herlin, assistant professor of Asian Studies and Government at Bowdoin, and Connie Ju, a native of Shanghai who works as a writer, teacher, and translator in Maine. Today on Maine Calling, First News. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The news out of China usually centers on air pollution, trade imbalances, or conflicts over islands in the South China Sea. Rarely, it seems, do we hear or learn about the everyday lives of people in China. Today, we're going to rectify that to some degree with Rob Schmitz. He's the Shanghai correspondent for NPR, formerly of Marketplace, and the author of a new book, Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. Also with me in studio is Connie Ju. She's a Maine-based writer, teacher, translator, and Chinese music radio host who is originally from Shanghai. She's also on MPBN's Community Advisory Board. And Christopher Herlin is also with us today. He's assistant professor of Asian Studies and Government at Bowdoin College. Thanks for joining us here today. Rob, as I said at the top of the show, we ID'd you as working for Marketplace, which is accurate. But in the last few minutes have learned that that you will now be working in Shanghai for NPR.
Yeah, starting in August, I'll be working as NPR Shanghai correspondent. I'm still technically with Marketplace up until mid-August, but yeah, a little shift of sorts.
Right. NPR also has a presence in Beijing as well.
They do, yeah. They have one correspondent, Anthony Kuhn, in Beijing, and I'll be replacing Frank Langfitt.
Okay, well, yeah. As always, we want to hear from you as well. What questions do you have about modern Chinese society? Our phone number is 800-399-3566, and you can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And Rob, we'll start with you. What is you, obviously, you've been in Shanghai for a while. You've covered its people, its politics, and you have a good sense also of how American media report on China. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the biggest misconception that the West, that Americans have of China and its people?
Well, I think, we're talking about my book today, but we're also talking about books in general. You know, there are so many books about China that have a dragon on the cover or a red star, something menacing, and you know, basically giving you the impression that, this is a bad country that wants to take over the world, or there's always this sort of underlying theme, I think, in a lot of coverage of China as well, that China is a quickly rising power that we should be scared of, and I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions about China. China is a very complicated country with an enormous population. Half of the population still hasn't really arrived to the middle class yet. And so China has a lot of domestic problems that it's trying to deal with. And I think that trying to expand its reach around the globe may be something that a lot of writers like to focus on. But I don't really think that that's really the agenda in Beijing.
Connie Ju, what's your take on maybe the biggest misconception we have, misperception of China?
I feel like sometimes it's not a misconception, but rather a lack of understanding. So definitely thanks very much, Rob, for writing this book, because I feel that a lot of times a lot of people look at China under big names, right? Communism, socialism, Red Scare or some kind of very mysterious Oriental, you know, culture, very much cloaked in these kind of cliché. And I think Rob's book is one of, I think there are more books like this now coming out that really focus on ordinary people. And I think he's picked some very good examples. These people certainly remind me of the people I know from Shanghai. I grew up in Shanghai mostly in the 70s and 80s, and my parents, my sister's family are still in Shanghai, so I visit there quite often. And the book kind of starts with people like of today in after year 2000 in the last 10 or 15 years. But I really like how it traces back to that background and reflects the history, the rich history of not only Shanghai, but of contemporary China. I think it's very hard to understand China just by big words, but I think it will be a lot more meaningful through people and through history of contemporary China.
Chris Hurl, and the same question to you. And, you know, as I'm listening to Connie, I'm thinking the, you know, the images that we had of Tiananmen Square, you know, often our perception of this country, because we've had limited access to it when I was growing up in the 60s, and certainly there was a lot of propaganda, a political posturing around it. And so that was our exposure to it. But then the images of Tiananmen Square, and then many of us just don't spend a lot of time educating ourselves about it. So this is what we come away with.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think the popular perception is definitely that the state in China is very, very repressive. But over the past 20 years or so, Chinese people have really become much more able to mount sort of narrow challenges to the government to defend their own kind of economic interests. So these kinds of protests over, you know, labor rights or wages, environmental protests, these kind of things are very common. And I think we see, you know, somewhat of a shift away from people just focusing on getting ahead economically or getting rich, and much more of a movement towards concern with sort of quality of life issues like the environment and things like that.
And so these protests, I think you've written about, are not only accepted by government officials, but they actually pay attention to them.
That's right. Yeah, they have actually a very elaborate bureaucracy set up for keeping track of protests and counting them and assembling statistics on them. So they pay very close attention to this. And not only that, but they actually act on this information, and they try to introduce new policies that will try to resolve some of these grievances that citizens have for the purpose of getting them to stop protesting.
Yeah. Most recently, there are a series of protests at outside of Kentucky Fried Chicken's over this issue in the South China Sea, which we don't need to get into. But it's interesting that then the government issues a statement, you know, criticizing the protesters. It's just unusual, but it's now become a part of this dance between the people and the government.
That's right. And it also sort of gets into another one of those common misperceptions of China, I think, which is that it's the state that really promotes nationalism, when in fact there's a lot of popular nationalism, right? People themselves care about some of these issues. So the state said it's not rational to protest against KFCs because you're upset about what's happening in the South China Sea.
But Rob Schmitz, there's also a difference between the way people perceive the National Party and its powers and, you know, Chairman Mao and the memory of that, and then local officials who are the ones who are kind of right upon them.
Right. And that you see that I see that all the time when I'm reporting, is that when you're going to cover a local protest or a local, you know, problem that somebody has, the narrative is usually the same. They always will say the same thing. They'll say the local government officials are these awful corrupt officials, but the central party if they only knew what was happening here, they would come in and change everything. And you hear that a lot. the truth of that is could be you know, that could be a topic of an entire talk show. But it's a very interesting narrative that I think the central government loves that narrative too, because it's a good cop, bad cop type of situation where the bad cops are always the local officials. And of course, Xi Jinping, the current ruler of China, when he came into power, he obviously launched an anti-corruption campaign, which was very popular with the people throughout China. And that's part of the reason that that was so popular.
But one story I heard in an interview with you was about you had written a story that had upset or gotten the attention of local officials. And so you were required and may still be required to report in with the police every once in a while. So, but they were just sort of acting also, these local police. They were not particularly intimidating either.
No. And you know, actually, the story that aroused such attention from the local police in Shanghai was actually one of the stories in my book. It's about this plot of land that is across the street from where I live in Shanghai called Maggie Lane. And it's a vacant plot of land with burned out homes when I arrive in 2010. And there's a few people still living there. And there's a very large, big story behind this plot of land. It is the most expensive piece of vacant land in Shanghai, probably in China, but it's not being developed on because there was a double murder there for basically the developer was trying to get land from the people that lived there, and they ended up killing two people. But you know, going back to what you were saying, I mean, I think you know, there are, and I think my book talks a lot about some of the local problems. And of course, that was a story that aroused. Of course, the city of Shanghai did not like that story, and so then they assigned two police officers to basically meet with me and have tea every quarterly. And actually, at first, I was a little nervous about that. But when I started meeting with them, I realized it wasn't really that big of a deal. We would just talk about politics for about an hour, and then there was usually like one or two items on their checklist that they had to remind me about, and that always came at the end of the conversation. And in fact, I had more questions for them than they had of me. And you know, they would complain about their jobs, they'd complain about not getting promotions, about all sorts of things, their pay. You know, so it was more of a, you know, I think it was more of a bureaucratic exercise than any kind of exercise in intimidation.
Yeah, Connie. So how long did you live in Shanghai? Did you grow up there, or what was your...
Yes, I was born and raised there, and I left there when I was 19
so
years old.
So how does your memory of Shanghai at that time, how does that compare to the stories, the characters that Rob, the place that Rob has depicted?
One of the characters, I say characters, they're actually real people.
Yeah.
One of the young people that you interviewed, he left Shanghai to go to school in the West and then worked in Hong Kong. I remember
Wei Qi.
He came back and he said, I feel detached
from
my old home.
Right.
And I feel like I said that many times. Every time I think I visited Shanghai roughly like 94, 96, 98, you know, every time I went home, I didn't know where my home was, because kind of like what Rob was just describing, this Maggie Lane, the forced relocation, the tearing down of old neighborhoods to build the new office buildings had been going on since mid-90s. My family neighborhood, this neighborhood I grew up in, was one of the earliest ones to be torn down, and it was a very painful experience because it was the earlier ones. So it's getting complicated, isn't it? Because before 49, all these houses were privately owned, and then they were stripped of their ownership, taken over by the Communist Party. And then after 80s, they started private. It's not really private ownership still, right? They call it a lease.
They
really
leased the land.
Yeah, so it's very complicated. So this house, my family used to own by my grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, what kind of were changing hands many times.
Right.
And eventually they were paid a sum of money, which was very low by today's standard, to move far away outside the city to a apartment complex wasn't even built. I'm sure you have covered that kind of instances. So my parents had to find temporary housing. So for a while in the 90s, every time I visited Shanghai, I didn't know where they were because they were always relocating to a temporary housing until their new cement, basically, right? Kind of an acre of cement blocks were finally built with nothing, maybe one convenience store for hundreds, thousands of families. So it is very complicated. I'm always a Shanghainese. I love Shanghai. But every time I go home, you know, there's that mixed feeling, like I'm coming home, but you don't have that feeling of going to where you grew up. So it's a very mixed feeling for me.
Yeah, and this property issue is a major social issue, an economic issue, right, Chris? And
it is, absolutely. Yeah, this is one of the biggest sources of government revenue, of tax revenues, especially in these places like Shanghai. So the governments are very interested in demolishing houses, putting in new high rises or something like that. And they don't have any property taxes like we do here in the U.S. So the only time they make money is when they sell the lease, the land use rights to these developers. And for the people, this is their most important asset, their house. And then I think some of the interesting things you get on the sort of the social side of this is when people sort of try and play games with the government. Like if it's the compensation says, well, you get, you know, one apartment for each household, then people get a fake divorce just for the purposes of getting this extra apartment. Or they add an extra level onto their house. They do all this illegal construction at the last minute because the compensation is based on square footage. Mm. So people are really trying to kind of work some of the flaws in the system to their advantage.
And Rob, in the case of your neighborhood, though, this got very dark. This wasn't, it's bad enough to lose your house. In one case, one man is homeless, but people died.
Yeah, at the time, the Shanghai government was making way for the 2010 World Expo, the World's Fair, which took place when I arrived in Shanghai in 2010. But 5 years earlier, they were trying to demolish a bunch of neighborhoods in the French Concession area where I live, former French Concession. And this was one of these neighborhoods that had a lot of folks who were not... I would say they were probably more middle class, upper middle class. They were educated. So they were good at fighting this intellectually and very good at building a case against the government for these illegal things that they were doing, which was trying to rough people up, throw stones through their windows, pour sewage into their windows. They've increasingly got desperate, the developer did, and so they hired a demolition crew to set fire to people's homes while they were in them. And one of those fires in 2005 got out of control and killed an elderly couple. The man was actually a People's Liberation Army veteran. He had fought for China in the Korean War against the Americans. And that made that whole project come to a standstill because the World's Fair was coming up. This was a terrible PR nightmare. And so they just built a wall around it, and they left the people who were remaining inside, and they had access to their own homes that were partially demolished. And so when I arrived in 2010, I looked across the street, and because my eighth floor apartment had a perfect viewing window of this area, and I couldn't believe what I saw because, you know, Shanghai is, when you go to Shanghai, it is a city that is just full of skyscrapers. It is the largest city you can imagine. It is just huge. And there's just skyscrapers as far as the eye can see, bold architecture. But here I was looking into this vacant lot in the most, probably one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the city. So it didn't really add up. And so I started looking into it and started getting to know the people who lived inside. And so one of those folks is a main character in my book.
And those who carried out the burning of the house were convicted.
They were convicted. They served one life sentence and then two reprieve death sentences. But a reprieve death sentence means that you're going to get out in about 20 years, maybe.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments about daily life in China. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life. And ever-present of Portland, securing family memories across generations, local services include photo scanning and converting home movies to DVD, everpresent.com.
This week, Republicans will convene in Cleveland to nominate Donald Trump for president. NPR and PBS NewsHour will be there, too. We're teaming up to bring you live coverage each night. I'm Rachel Martin. Join me, Judy Woodruff, and Gwen Ifill for speeches, interviews, and analysis live from the Republican National Convention. Special coverage from PBS NewsHour and NPR News.
Full coverage tonight and tomorrow starting at 8 on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television.
Cinema loves upward mobility.
A matchbox of our own. A fence. A three-wheeled chain link.
How Hollywood stokes America's middle-class aspirations, that and the latest from the GOP convention, next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered gets underway this afternoon at 4.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Life in Modern China. With me in our studio, Connie Zhu is a writer, Chinese language teacher, translator, and music host. Christopher Herlin teaches Asian studies at Bowdoin College, and Rob Schmitz covers Shanghai for NPR, a new position. He's been with Marketplace and, well, technically still is with Marketplace. He's written a book about his observations in Shanghai. We invite you to join the conversation as well. The number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Let's keep it in Shanghai for the moment. Mm-hmm. Is a place that's changing, as you mentioned before the break. There are skyscrapers, there are BMWs and Mercedes Benzes, and this is a whole new way of life, a whole new life of wealth, but opportunities to some extent. But it's also meant some real difficulty for particularly people of certain generations to adapt.
That's right.
Because
that's right.
They've lived a life that really was controlled by the party, and
right.
where they lived and what they did was controlled, and now it's up to them.
Yeah, so one of my characters, Auntie Fu, and her husband, Uncle Feng, they were born around the birth of Communist China in 1949, or when the Communists finally took over China. And so they grew up with these campaigns. They were sent down. They helped build Xinjiang, which is the northwest region of China. At the time, it was it was debatable whether it was part of China, and so China started to colonize it using these farms called Bingtuan, and so they helped colonize Xinjiang, and then they were sent back to Shanghai and worked there. So up until the age of 40 years old, they really hadn't made a single career decision for themselves. So today, Auntie Fu is in her 60s, and she looks around her, and she lives on the street that I profile, and she just sees a lot of wealthy people and a lot of fancy cars, but she's wondering, how did I miss out on this? Why aren't I wealthy? What did I do wrong? She really wasn't trained for capitalism. The party had made all decisions for her up until she was, an adult and going into her 50s. And so I follow her as she goes from one investment scam to another. She takes me to these investment scam meetings, these Ponzi, they're basically Ponzi schemes and they're pyramid schemes. And so we're going for the most ridiculous products you can imagine. And she believes that these schemes will get her rich, but of course they're just get-rich-quick schemes, and she loses a lot of her money, and she pours a lot of her pension into this. So there's an entire part of the book where I'm trying to get her out of that.
There's one. Yeah. There's one only because it's funny. It's about some sort of poultice or something you apply in your pants, and it's supposed to. Yeah.
So one of the products is a sexual health pad that you put in your underwear, and it's supposed to rid you of your toxins. And so the meeting we go to is actually one of the chapters in my book, or it's a good portion of the chapter.
But it's a funny story, but it's sad to the extent that she's desperate. I mean, I guess there are the equivalents of people who have struggled economically playing the lottery desperately. But in this case, it's much more intense because she really has no way to access it.
She doesn't have access to the internet. She can't afford it. She doesn't have a smartphone. So she can't put into Baidu, which is the Chinese version of Google, whether this is a scam, if people have been scammed in other parts of China. And so there's an entire population right now in China of older people around this generation that don't have much money, don't have access to information, and make very poor decisions because they really haven't been trained to do so.
Connie, is that your sense also that there, while there are generational divides in every culture and every country, but is it intensified, do you think, possibly in China with this generation that grew up under tight communist control? Versus a younger generation that might have access to wealth that is more comfortable with technology, are those differences heightened?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely intensify the generational changes because let's just say there was the 10-year cultural revolution from 66 to 76, then 76 to 86 is a transition, you know, from Mao's Communist Party to Deng Xiaoping's Communist Party, and then we had the 89, the Tiananmen Square event. After that, China pretty much, you know, consolidated political control and started the economic miracle, literally, because the country just absolutely took off and the wealth just absolutely swelled, I would say. So, of course, it totally intensified the changes between generations. And I think it's very interesting in this book, the book not only covered like Auntie Fu, that generation, but I think it's very interesting, really made me think, was its portrayal of the younger generation. Yes, they have more freedom. They have more choices. They can choose what they work, right? Because this young guy selling accordions, I thought it was a fascinating story. And then opening up a sandwich shop, you know, which was unthink of, you know, to my parents' generation. And but then it's very interesting. I think you brought up the question. So there is freedom, but there are also limits. So what are the younger generation negotiating with, because it's not just all freedom, right? I mean, the older generation had their limits, but the younger generation, I think it's very interesting. Like, what does system mean for the younger generation, right? For the older generation, it's the party, it's the communist system that was very rigid. But these days, it's kind of loosened up, but they still have to fight against certain limits.
It has loosened up, but I think that there are still very, very distinct lines that are not crossed and should not be crossed. I think in the book, I compare this to swimming in a rip current and in waters with a rip current, that there's five characters in my book, and some of them try to swim against the current. And if you've been caught in a rip current, you know that that's not what you do, because you will end up drowning. If you try, you'll just get exhausted and drown. And the ones who survive, the ones who do well, are usually the ones who can kind of go with the system's current, but have sort of go at their own diagonal or at their own angle in some ways, trying to find loopholes there to get out of it or to find their own personal freedom on the way.
Yeah. Connie's referred earlier to this. We're calling them characters, but they are real people.
Yeah.
But he's a young entrepreneur who just give us a brief. He's opened a sandwich shop, which is unusual. And plus, it's on the second floor, and it's sort of hidden behind a tree, so you can't see it.
Right.
So he has supplements his income by selling accordions.
So his name is Chen Kai, also known as CK. He's in his 30s now. And he was born in the 1980s. His parents worked for state-owned factories, and he grew up in a really rough part of China, and ended up getting a very good grades when he was in high school, and got out of there and became a musician, and learned to play the accordion, also learned to assemble an accordion after he graduated. He worked for a state-owned instrument maker. And then he realized that the state factory system was not for him. He wasn't learning anything. He wanted to learn. He was very curious. And so he ends up quitting and finds a job in Shanghai with an Italian engineer who had just quit a job with Ferrari to design accordions, because accordions are very complicated instruments. And so he teaches CK, this 20-something-year-old kid, how to assemble and disassemble an accordion so that he can then train migrant workers to do it. And he, by doing this, CK makes a lot of money. He makes more than an average an American. And so he has enough money then to buy a sandwich shop, because he had enough money to go to the U.S. and travel a little. And in Chicago, he saw a sandwich shop that inspired him to start a sandwich shop. And so he comes back to Shanghai. He doesn't have the greatest business sense. And he establishes a sandwich shop on the second floor. But the problem is that in this neighborhood, in the former French Concession, there are trees that line the avenues. And these trees are stunted in their growth so that they all kind of poof out on the second floor. So you literally cannot see anything on a building on the second floor, because you're shielded from these trees. So no one can see it. And so he doesn't have many customers. And so it's all about him trying to make a go at this business. But also it's a spiritual quest that he's on later on in the book, where he starts to become interested in Buddhism. And I think that also is one of the hallmarks of this younger generation in China right now, is that there is a religious renaissance happening right now in China. It is very interesting to watch. It's very exciting. There are now more, and Christianity, of course, is the number one religion that people are turning to. And that, for the party, can be problematic, because they see it as a foreign religion. But a lot of Chinese, like CK, are going to what are considered more indigenous religions. Of course, Buddhism came from India, but it was brought to China. It has a tradition in China. And so he goes to Buddhism. A lot of people are going to Taoism. But there is a religious revival going on among young people right now, because they're looking for a meaning of life. Because for so long, all Chinese were on the same sort of wave. Like, they wanted to make money, even the state, right? Everyone wanted to raise their GDP. But now that GDP has been reached for folks in urban areas, and now they're looking for something more beyond material goods. They're looking for value system. They're looking for a meaning of life.
And I'm wondering, to do that, though, we've seen in other places where there's been oppression, where people have been oppressed, that they've come through a period of reconciliation. They went back into the past, and they unpacked the ugliness of it, and they looked it in the face so that they could move on. I'm sensing that that's not happening, though, in China.
Well, it is in a certain sense. When you look at the Xi Jinping's guiding principle, the Zhongguo Meng, it's called in Chinese, the Chinese dream, there is an interesting cultural aspect to this principle, and one of it is to revive Confucianism. And so the idea is that the government right now is putting a lot of money into reviving Confucian ideals. They're setting up what's called the Confucian Institutes. They're also helping rebuild Taoist and Buddhist temples. So there is some government support here, but they're trying to corral, I think, people to a certain place that is more distinctly Chinese than it is foreign.
But there's no chance of shining a critical light on Mao, or re-examining history in China at this point.
No, not too much. I think the official verdict was that Mao was 70% right and 30% wrong, and there's not going to be too much deviation from that. But I think one of the big successes that the Communist Party in China has had is convincing people that communism is Chinese. And there's always this juxtaposition between democracy, which is Western, versus communism is Chinese, despite the fact that it comes from Marx and Lenin and all of these other Western leaders. Right.
But in some ways, are the protests we talked about earlier, is that their version of democracy? That is – That's the way they get to express themselves and, you know, cast a vote, quote-unquote.
I think it's maybe best thought of as bargaining, that this is sort of a game that people play with the government, and the objective is not to win the game, but to get more money for having played the game.
Yeah. The other impression I think that we get visually and also from environmentalist groups is that China is very polluted, that it is a major source of, you know, of air pollution, et cetera, and is not protecting its people from that. What is the sense, Connie, of the Chinese people or of people in Shanghai about that issue? Is it a major concern? Is it something that worries them, that they think about, that's front and center in their lives, or are they occupied by other things?
Well, like Rob pointed earlier, there is a rising class, especially in urban cities like Shanghai. There's the educated class, the middle class. They're doing very well. And I think definitely environmentalist concern is a major concern for this group of people. And they are also the people who are sending their kids out. I mean, Maine has been benefiting from this, I believe. There are a lot of middle school students, college students coming from China. And but I think for the, I mean, I hate to say lower class, but maybe more working class, right, who are still struggling just to get a job, you know, to support their family, maybe that is a somewhat lower concern. And also geographically speaking, Beijing, I think, probably has a much more severe problem than Shanghai. And I think it's a very, really reached a pretty critical kind of point in Beijing these days.
Yeah, I think the environment is becoming a big concern among people. I mean, you know, society in China is centered around a family and children. And if anything hurts children, the Chinese will voice their anger. You may recall the melamine in the milk scandal in 2000, I think it was 2008, where children died because a company that made milk had used a toxic chemical in the milk to save money. That led to a lot of people being, you know, very, very angry, and they were not afraid to protest about that. I think the environment is also one of these things. Air pollution is a problem all over urban China, and I think you're starting to see more and more people get very upset, not only just about the general issue, but whenever a garbage incinerator is going to be built in your area, that will bring people out. People will come to the streets and toss over police cars and get very angry about it. And then Chris was just talking about how the government is now starting to try and solve these problems. And oftentimes, these protesters are starting to get what they want.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments, the number 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, we are live from Cleveland with special coverage of the Republican National Convention. In the thick of it with all the action, insight, and latest news, we're taking your calls. Don't miss it. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins our special convention coverage here on Maine Public Radio at 7. Also, join us at 8 on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television for complete coverage of the convention.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Dacre Keltner. In his new book, The Power Paradox, the professor of psychology reveals the secret to how we gain and keep power. He'll discuss this and more with Michael Lewis next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, coming up after Maine Calling at 2, here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a look at daily life in China. Today with me in our studio, Christopher Herlin teaches Asian Studies and Government at Bowdoin College. Rob Schmitz is an author and China reporter for NPR, formerly of Marketplace. And Connie Zhu teaches and translates Chinese, and she hosts a Chinese music show here in Portland. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. 3566. As we're painting kind of a picture here of the central Communist Party relaxing its grip somewhat, being more accommodating of protests, but it's still fair to say that it is still the boss. It still controls the private lives of Chinese people in ways that we would never consider acceptable. Is that a fair way of putting it? Go ahead, Chris.
I think so. So it's still definitely a politically very closed and authoritarian regime, right? So in the sense that you can't go out on the streets and protest for democracy or something like that. And especially in the past couple of years, there's been a crackdown, not so much on the normal protesters who are complaining about economic issues, but on people like rights, human rights lawyers, or on NGOs, Christian groups, other religious minorities. So all of these groups that are seen by the state as having maybe some kind of political claims or political grievances, they're now being much more tightly repressed than they were, say, 5 years ago.
I think if you're trying to protest about a garbage incinerator, you're going to be that'll be fine. But once you start protesting the central government and questioning their legitimacy, that's when you're going to have some big problems, especially under this the current leader.
But and what you were saying is most people are more critical of local authorities. Anyway.
They are, they are. But I think you spend more time with folks. I mean, they would, like Americans, Chinese people love to complain. I think that's just people just sit around and complain a lot. And you were talking about in the beginning, some of the misconceptions of the Chinese. I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that they're very different from Americans. In fact, I find the Chinese in the way their sense of justice being fair is very, very similar to how Americans are. When something isn't fair, I think most people in China get very, very angry about it, and they can be moved to do something about it if maybe it's even not in their best interest to do that.
And one of the things that your book does is it in humanizing these people is we see ourselves in each of these characters, although our situations are not the same, but they are the same human traits that we see all over the world, and so it helps strip the sense that, as we often try to do, is oversimplify people and call them the Chinese.
Right.
It's this very diverse group of cultures and language and experiences, but we're all human. So it was an interesting exercise in that. I did want to follow up, though, on this, asking whether you had been under any pressure other than the chats you have with the local police. But were you nervous about, writing in this book about these people who could be identified, getting them into trouble, or in the course of your reporting, saying something about the government that was critical?
Yeah, it's something that I'm always nervous about. So when I went to, this was started out as a radio series, this book, about that lasted about a year. Every month for a year, I had a profile of someone who lived and worked along a single street in Shanghai, the street that I live on. And then it became, then I started writing the book. And when I wrote the book, I wanted to focus on certain characters that I thought would illuminate certain generations or certain types of people who live in contemporary China. And so the folks that I talked to, some folks said no. They said, I don't want to be involved in something like that. But the characters in the book, all of them said yes. Two of the narratives, I've decided on one of them for Auntie Fu and Uncle Feng, that's not their real name. Because they were involved in a lot of illegal pyramid schemes, I didn't want to get them in trouble. And so I decided to change their name. They said that they'd be fine with me using their real name. I decided myself that that wasn't a good idea, that they could get in trouble down the line, perhaps. And so I wanted to be safe about that. Mm. Another person whose name I changed because he requested it was a descendant of a man who is one of the five narratives. It's a box of letters that a friend gives me who is Chinese, and she goes to junk shops and buys a bunch of just random stuff. And she had this box of letters that were all addressed to the street that I was profiling. And so she lent me the letters. There were more than 100 of them, and they were between a man who was arrested as a capitalist in 1957 and then sent to a labor prison or a labor camp in Western China. And his wife, who was stuck back on the street with her 7 children. And so I find, in the end, I find one of the children who happens to be in New York City. And he does not want his family's name being used because he's still really worried about the political repercussions to his family.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Let's go to, I think it's Magda. Magda, is that your name?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Thank you for having me. It's a fabulous program. And my question is, what are the social services for the retired people? Social services like payments, health care, and that sort of thing in the new China.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot in the way of social services for the elderly. So most of them end up relying on their grown children. But there has been some efforts in the past 10, 15 years to build out more of a social security system. But it's still a developing country, so there's not a whole lot in the way of benefits.
Well, it's interesting because I think our perception of a socialist country is this is what it does.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It starts there and takes care of everybody, but in particular.
That's definitely not
doesn't.
The case.
Yeah.
No, actually, more and more I see is that the Chinese envy Americans because they feel that America provides a lot better social security, the safety net. And I certainly see more and more including my friends, you know, a lot of older Chinese, they come to this country to retire to you know, in America, kind of to go back to what we were talking before, how kind of the economic development in China has changed the kind of the social fabric. And traditionally, yes, Chinese are supposed to take care of your own family members. Right. You know, the older take care of the young take care of the older. But because so many people have moved away from their homes in the country to swarm into the cities to make money, and a lot of people leave the country, including me, you know, to foreign countries. So the social or the organization of the social units have really changed. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't it in the last couple of years there was like a government, what would you call it?
Yeah, no, there's a rule.
Order, right?
Yeah, that you can actually sue your children for not taking care of you. And,
yeah.
and that can, you can actually win lawsuits against your children for not being there. When you need them, which is a very Chinese law in some ways.
Right. Yeah. Let's go to Presque Isle and Orpheus. Hi, Orpheus. Just a couple minutes left here.
Yes, I taught there, started teaching in 2005. Fell in love with teaching in Shanghai, and actually lived for a time in one of the apartment complexes. And I lived in an older apartment complex as the only foreigner. And from 2005 to 2010, they were building for the expo. And the people in my building, they knew who I was. And at 6'4", I kind of was a little different. And they treated me as their special foreign person. But the policeman in the building, one night I brought a colleague, to my house before we went out on the town, and, we're going up in the elevator, and, he very sternly wanted to know, what I was doing, taking an unmarried woman to my apartment. And yet he was younger than I was. He was only in his 30s, but he had no qualms about asking me that question. And my colleague was highly upset because it's something that we would do here normally. You know, let me stop at my house and fix something, and then we'll go out. And he was assuming the worst. That was at the height of the expo, and they were very nervous about the image that the city projected. But when you got down on the street level, door to door, you had wonderfully warm people who cared about you. I don't know how often they got me an ambulance when I needed a medical emergency dealt with and things like that, that you would expect here in the U.S. So you have the government speak, and then you have the wonderful people helping people aspect that made it a wonderful period of time while I taught.
Yeah, interesting. So, and the government does have this practice of protecting appearance and urging people to act in a certain way or not act in a certain way.
Yeah, and I think that what the caller experienced is not unusual. I think there's been a lot of foreigners who go to China experience the same thing. And I think what he said about folks on the street being very warm and caring is also very true. And that's when I wrote this book, that's sort of what I wanted to focus on, because I feel like there's a China that isn't really portrayed in the West too much, and that's the street level.
Yeah. So literally about a minute left. Are concerns that, you know, China's economy will collapse and everything will fall apart? I mean, what's your take really on what we should how things you see this playing out here?
Yeah, it's funny. 3 years ago when I did a speaking tour in the United States, I had a little sabbatical, and so I did some speaking events at universities. Everyone asked me in the U.S., when is China going to finally take over the United States? Now, when I do it, I was just on a book tour promoting my book. The question is, when is China going to collapse? So I think, you know, everything is so black and white. You know, China probably is not going to collapse. The party will most likely stay in power. I don't really think economically we're going to see a collapse. I think things will probably stagnate for a while, because you've had 30 years of unprecedented economic growth, and China's economic system needs to be tweaked a little for it to have a long-term sustainability. And I think so we're going to see kind of a slow period for these next 10, maybe 20, maybe longer years.
All right. Rob, Connie, Christopher, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Schmitz is Shanghai correspondent for NPR, formerly, sort of currently, for Marketplace, and the author of the new book, Street of Eternal Happiness. Connie Zhu is an author, teacher, translator, and Chinese music radio host who grew up in Shanghai. She's also on MPBN's Community Advisory Board. And Christopher Herlin is assistant professor of Asian Studies and Government at Bowdoin College. And for those of you in and around the Portland area this evening, Rob, you're giving a talk at Longfellow Books at 7. Okay. John Keimel ran the board today. Our intern, Hannah McCool, answered your calls, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thursday on the program, join me for a conversation about the Republican National Convention, from the expected to the unexpected. We'll discuss what's happened so far in Cleveland this week and what to expect tomorrow night when Donald Trump delivers his Republican presidential nomination acceptance speech. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.